This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. 50 years ago, one-third of U.S. workers carried a union card. For many, union jobs were a source of pride and a ticket to the middle class. In today's more competitive global business environment, 12% of American workers belong to a union, and that number is 8% if you're looking at just the private sector. Many union leaders blame this gloomy news on globalization, on corporate greed, and on the Republican Party. Andy Stern looks at it from another point of view. If any other $6.5 billion corporation lost customers every year and still insisted its business plan was fine, executive heads would have rolled long ago. And since this maverick is also the president of the biggest and fastest growing union in the country, organized labor is listening, though not always happily. Leaders of the AFL-CIO met in Las Vegas early last month to debate the future and Andy Stern's provocative demands to reorganize organized labor. Stern wants fewer, stronger, and more coherent unions, even if that means forced mergers. And as corporations go global, he says, labor must follow. Later in the program, the media and rural America, no news here, and your letters. But first, new thinking on the future of organized labor. If you're a union member, is it time for a change? Would Andy Stern's ideas make unions stronger or just more corporate? What's organized labor's role in the 21st century economy? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. Andy Stern is with us here in Studio 3A. He's the president of the Service Employees International Union. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Neil.
Why has every attempt to organize a Walmart store failed?
Well, Walmart is now the largest employer in America. It's made a decision at the highest levels of the company to not let workers have a free choice. They claim it's their business model. But the truth is, it is a bully to its workers. It's a bully to communities. It doesn't pay its fair share. And the truth is, if you gave workers a free choice in Walmart, at least for those who stayed long enough, since the turnover is 50% a year, I think you'd find that people want to change. They want to have a voice. They want to have the kind of wages and benefits that the Walton family members are able to enjoy.
Well, you're describing a different kind of company. You want a different kind of union to address that company on workers' issues.
Well, I think we're not going to solve the Walmart problem one Walmart store at a time. When you think about how the labor movement was formed 50 years ago, people didn't organize one GM plant. They organized GM. Because really, in the end, you're fighting against the whole corporate structure. And the labor movement has to have plans that are big enough and large enough and thoughtful enough to be able to solve the problems for the workers at Walmart, but also to make Walmart a competitive employer as well.
So looking out for the business side as well.
Absolutely. I mean, businesses are in business to make money, and they do have competition. We want to make sure the competition isn't about hurting workers. It isn't about taking away workers' benefits. We want to level the playing field so that every company pays the same kind of minimum benefits, the minimum wages, and then they can compete about technology and efficiency and productivity, but they shouldn't compete by hurting the workers that work for them.
And why is that kind of organization not possible now?
Because the laws in this country have really eroded from the time when we had a single factory or we had an industrial society. Now we have a huge service economy with rules and laws that really weren't made for it. And the truth is the employers have too much power in these particular situations. Report after report from Congress and Amnesty International says the freedom for workers to make a fair choice in our country has gone away. And in fact, it needs to be restored. But here's the good news. 40% of American workers, when asked, say if given a free choice, they'd join a union.
40%?
40%.
So there's an enormous untapped potential between that 12% number we gave at the beginning of the program and 40% who said, if I could, I would.
And part of that is clearly changing the laws, but a lot of that is also changing ourselves, and that's what the discussion in the AFL-CIO is about.
Well, what came out of that meeting?
Well, in Las Vegas, I was very disappointed. We came in with an idea that maybe we could grow stronger again, that SEIU's made an enormous amount of changes in our own union. And just the other day, 49,000 private sector family daycare providers, people like Daisy Martin, who for $6 an hour takes care of 4 kids in her home and actually also pays for their food and the upkeep on her place, voted to have a union so she could change her life. And we said all the Daisy Martins in the U.S. should have a chance to join a union, but that means we need to change. We need to change the laws, but we also need to have bigger unions and more focused unions and spend more resources on growth, because what we've been doing hasn't worked, and we should do something different if we're going to be successful.
All right. Beginning with some of those ideas. Fewer unions. That means there are too many unions now, you think, and they have to be merged whether they want to or not.
We live in a world where companies are getting bigger and stronger. They're not just local anymore. They're national and international in character. And yet the labor movement is still too focused at a local level. And unions aren't coordinating or cooperating. So we have 15 unions in the construction industry, 15 unions in airlines, 6 unions in healthcare, all with no common plan or no common strategy, and they're just not strong enough or coordinated enough to be successful. That's why we have to let workers have a choice to vote to be in bigger and stronger and more focused unions.
Another word that you used in there was growth. That means going out and organizing workers.
Yeah, you have to talk to workers in order to grow. Clearly, there are obstacles in terms of employer behavior and the law, but a big obstacle is we're not spending enough of our resources. This is a $6 billion industry, if you think about it in corporate terms, and yet less than 5% is being spent on growth. You're not going to grow stronger if you don't spend your resources trying to do it.
So that would involve a diversion of money away from the central organization, the AFL-CIO, more towards locals.
But what we need to do is two things. One is the AFL-CIO needs to be focused on growth, and as you said, return its money to unions who are going to do the right thing. They're going to focus on a specific industry, and they're going to spend their own resources on growth. So it means the national unions need to spend more resources on growth, and the AFL-CIO has to stimulate, be a catalyst to make that happen.
And of all these issues in Las Vegas, what'd you get?
Well, basically what we got is a strategy that basically says this: if we give more money to Democratic politicians, we'll be able to change our lives. Because the plan that came out of Las Vegas, which was very unfortunate, was we can't grow until we change the laws. We can't grow until politicians behave differently. We can't change until corporations behave differently. But what we didn't say is maybe we could change ourselves. Maybe we could do what our union has been doing, which is grow by refocusing our resources. But instead it was, let's give more money to politicians and hope we get a different result.
And you're also disappointed to some degree with the Democratic Party. We'll get into that later. But while we're talking about unions, given that response, among the things you'd said was, look, you guys, we need to reorganize from the top down, or else the SEIU, your biggest union, may leave.
What we've said is, we want to be part of a dynamic, new, bold, 21st century growing organization that rewards and values American workers' work, that the AFL should be that organization. And if it's not, we don't want to be part of it, but partners with it, and take the money that we're currently spending, over $10 million a year, and try to invest it so more Daisy Martins get a chance to change their lives and see their work rewarded.
But isn't that, if that's the case, if the SEIU does leave, aren't you tearing apart the labor movement?
Well, the labor movement is divided right now. I mean, as you started the show, 88% of American workers aren't in unions. Only 12% are. 15 unions in construction, unions in the airline industry by craft, by company. We're a divided labor movement, and unless we get united, then we're not going to be successful. And that's what this discussion is all about.
Let's get some listeners involved in this conversation. 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And we'll start with Doug, who's calling from Sacramento in California.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
I am a union member. One of my large concerns is that the unions don't seem to be holding their own for their current members. It's not good advertising for getting other members or inroads into other corporations if you're allowing corporations to, during negotiations, split the union. So you've got two levels of benefits. You've got unions being kicked out of corporations. You need to reorganize to the point where you've got the strength and support of your current locals to be able to grow. We're the best advertisement there is out there. We're constantly talking to other people within our same industry, other workers that we want to try to organize, to get mobilized. The unions need to look to their current members to try and grow, but there's not the leadership, I don't believe.
I totally agree with you. What we said to our members is, if we're going to win for them, if we're going to change their lives, then we have to be strong enough to do that. Part of that is making sure we have a union that has strong ability to mobilize. But part of it is also to be big enough and strong enough to get the job done. No single local union is going to be able to take on Walmart and win. No single local union is going to be able to take on a global security company and win. And so we have a plan that we've made those changes in our own union and now ask the AFL-CIO to adopt to say two things. One is we have to change ourselves and make our current members vote on a plan to give them the greatest strength they have. And two is we have to grow strong, even stronger, because that's what's happening with global corporations every single day. They're growing stronger. We're growing smaller.
If to achieve that, Doug, you were asked to vote on whether to join, keep your current union or join a much bigger union, what would you do?
At this point, I'm a little torn because we're losing our president, I believe, next year. And it's a wait-and-see attitude. I frankly believe that the union, our union has some strength and some really quality people at the national level. But we need to kick some tail, I guess, to get them to bring professionals into negotiations. And I think it's best to work with what we've got, to improve what we've got. I don't think it's going to change going to a different union. I think everybody's pretty much in the same boat. As far as the AFL-CIO, they need to show more leadership down the line. They need to mobilize. I'm with Communication Workers of America, a great union, but what they need to do is within our region is to mobilize the CWA with all the other unions. We need to show some solidarity.
And Andy Stern, we have about 20 seconds.
I was just going to say, what we're watching in the communication industry, now we have Arise emerging with Quest. The unions are getting bigger, and yet in communications we have the IBW and the CWA and other unions and other companies that are not union yet, and they're driving down the wages and benefits. And so we need more strength in the communication industry as well.
Doug, thanks very much for the call.
We appreciate it.
We're talking about re-engineering organized labor to better meet the needs of its local and international members. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us. TOTN at NPR.org. Back after the break. This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about reorganizing organized labor to better meet the needs of its members. You're invited to join us, of course, if you're in a union or if you're in management and deal with unions. Give us a phone call. What do you want unions to be doing at this juncture in time? 800-989-8255. Email TOTN at NPR.org. Our guest is Andrew Stern, Service Employees International Union President. And I wanted to ask you, there's a model that you cite as an example of how things can work. It involves organizing janitors in northern New Jersey.
That's right. In northern New Jersey, we've had janitors right across the river from New York City working for the same companies and yet making minimum wage. But we understood that if we went after just one company and raised their wages, then the other companies would just continue to underbid them and those workers would lose their job. And so we used first the power of persuasion and got a number of the responsible employers to say, if you can get the other employers to come together with us, we're willing to have a discussion about how to set one wage and benefit standards that we're all going to use. And then we used the persuasion of power on some other employers who weren't so interested in participating in the conversation, and eventually they agreed. Now Rita Cortez, who was a janitor in New Jersey who made $5.15 an hour and had no vacation, makes $10.75 an hour, has health care, and took her first three-week vacation. That's what happens when you have a model that works, that involves workers, but also appreciates the competitive nature of the marketplace.
So you were not approaching the company presidents as if they were out to squeeze every last nickel out of their wage slaves.
Now, what a lot of employers tell us is that it's very hard to run a business where you're paying minimum wage, you're constantly hiring new people, they have less training and skill and experience, that they want a little bit more stability, but their competitors keep spending paying less and less, and that makes them less competitive. So we said we want to make sure that all the workers make the same amount of money, and then the ones that do the best job in terms of quality and efficiency and productivity and innovation are the ones that are succeed, not the ones that could hurt the workers the most. And in the end, we were able to get about 70% of the employers to enter negotiations. We have contracts that have doubled the wages, increased the health care benefits, and given people vacations, and the employers have a much more stable, qualified, and quality workforce. It's worked out for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Let's get another caller on the line. This is Tom. Tom's calling from Philadelphia.
Hi. Mr. Stern, I'm in the bricklayers union, and we've just gone through a lot of mergers and, you know, in locally, where we merged with the stonemasons, the tile setters, and, you know, several other unions, about nine of them. And, you know, it's working very well for us, but I don't think that we need to have further mergers because, I don't think our people want to be merged with the Carpenters Union, for instance.
Why not?
Or we would be overwhelmed.
Oh, you'd be overwhelmed. You wouldn't have enough numbers.
Well, we just, you know, it would just, we're afraid of it, basically.
Hmm.
And I don't see how, you know, merging the construction unions, maybe in some instances, but to just merge, like say, you know, the bricklayers, the stonemasons, carpenters, and maybe, I don't know, other people.
Throw some electricians in there, too.
Well, electricians, that's more of a mechanical thing. They're their own thing. But I've heard talk of this for years where they say that the plumbers and pipe fitters and electricians and certain mechanical trades would merge into one. But, you know, I just think it's trade would be lost, I think.
First of all, I think the key question we all have to ask ourselves is what is the best way to organize ourselves to value and reward work and win and change the lives of members. 10 years ago, trust me, if I had mentioned those four unions merging together, people would have told me, you know, stop talking about it, leave me alone. But to your credit, you've made a decision that you could be stronger with four or five unions merging together. I think it's a fair question now to ask is, shouldn't the building trade union leaders bring forward a plan and let their members vote if they think there are better ways? And maybe it is the carpenters or maybe it isn't. But the truth is there are less and less construction workers in unions. The health care costs and other problems with pensions are putting a lot of pressure on construction unions. The residential industry is still pretty non-union in the construction area.
Right.
And I think we need a plan to be successful and win. And if that means growing stronger, I trust the members to vote on whether they think it's in their best interest or not.
Well, that's great. But, you know, couldn't it be possible to just have give the local building trades more authority and reduce the individual.
Absolutely. I mean, there are lots of ways we could solve the problem, because what you're saying is there are 15 different building trades unions, but they all belong to one organization. And why doesn't that organization have a little bit more authority to coordinate and direct the work in order to be more
successful? We have the best people. I mean, and we do training. We have a great training center here. All the locals do. All the different trades, and we basically, whenever a non-union, most non-union guys, after they get a few years under their belt, they want to join the union because we have better wages, and we steal the cream of the crop from the non-union a lot of times anyway.
Well, what Tom says, that's true in a union state like Pennsylvania. It's not true in Arizona.
No, absolutely. I mean, there are whole, huge parts of America, you know, that this conversation about unions are not relevant because, A, there aren't any unions, and B, no one's trying to organize unions down there. In fact, at our convention, we totally restructured our union in order to create tens of millions of more dollars going to the South and the Southwest, because we can't have a red and blue state labor movement. We have to have a labor movement in every single state, and that includes the South and Southwest. I come from Philadelphia. It is about as strong a union town as you can get. I wish it was true everywhere else, but that's not going to happen unless we begin to spend our money to grow stronger in every part of America.
Let's get another caller in. Tim. Tim's calling from Dayton, Ohio.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I have been a member of the Carpenters Union for over 30 years, and I'm listening to this conversation, and come to the realization that there are some things that are not being addressed in this conversation. Is anyone there?
Yep, yep. We're listening.
Okay. We have one of the reasons why most of the trade unions are losing ground is due to illegal immigration, number one. The other item is your guest has it right. If we could vote, that would be great. The carpenters lost their right to vote on any contract covering wages, benefits, anything in the mid-'80s. The International came in, declared most district or most locals insolvent, removed business agents that were duly elected by the local membership, and then became appointed by the International. And then after that happened, they controlled everything. And ever since then, the carpenters have become a bottom-up pyramid scheme. All the money goes up to the International, and nothing comes back. So once the carpenters get a right to vote on anything, and that's why your bricklayer is totally scared to join the carpenters, and that's why all trade members should be totally scared to join the carpenters. We haven't had the ability to vote on any contract since the International took us over in the mid-'80s.
Well, let's get a response to that from Andy Stern.
Well, I don't know all the specifics about carpenters union, but let me answer your question about you know, workers that are here in this country and working from other countries. You know, you called them, I think, illegal immigrants. I would call them undocumented workers. But the truth is the building trades was built by Italian and Polish and Irish workers who came from other countries, you know, who found a job in a trade and were able to live the American dream. And we just have another group of people now in our country trying to do the same thing. My question is, why don't we organize those workers? We organize the Irish, we organize the Italians and the Poles and everybody else who did those trades. It's time every worker have a right to have a union. And it certainly is true that I believe that every worker have a right, you know, to make some democratic choices about their own union and its future and its officers. You know, and I would hope that was true in the carpenters.
But as you face a situation where you have now, from your point of view, a union movement that fractures its influence and power in all of these smaller organizations. You've got the union movement's political allies in the Democratic Party no longer control the House of Representatives, the United States Senate, or the White House. Some people would look at that and say, "Well, you know, this is a movement whose time has passed."
I mean, I think we're going in the wrong direction, and that's what the discussion the AFL-CIO is about. How do we win again? How do we reward work again? From our perspective, you know, we have shown that you can change, spend resources, make a plan, involve your members, and you can grow. So this is not impossible. It's just a question of, A, changing ourselves, and then, B, asking our friends and allies in both political parties to make sure that workers have a free choice. And the truth is the Democratic Party has lost its voice, it's lost its moral compass as it comes to rewarding work of workers. I mean, where is the Democratic Party talking about the price of oil in America? How is the Democratic Party letting that bankruptcy bill, you know, go through with so many Democratic votes in favor? I mean, the Democratic Party is no longer the party of people who work. They've lost their voice and their moral compass. And I think we need to make sure that they and the Republicans are parties that stand for people who go to work every day. I just want to say, people wake up every morning and they don't think about whether they're in a red state or a blue state. They think about, you know, how am I going to get my kid off to school? You know, how am I going to get to work on time? Does my health care coverage really cover this? My mom's getting older. Where is she going to find a nursing home? That's what people are thinking about, and neither political party is really speaking to those interests.
And if a Democratic candidate in a district didn't vote, for example, against the bankruptcy bill, would you be inclined to run a candidate against that person in the Democratic primary?
Well, I think as we've learned in the labor movement, it's really time to raise our voices a little bit more and not just follow orthodoxy, even though at times the conversation is painful. And I think it is time to have a serious discussion to look at what the Republicans did with the Club for Growth, you know, where they decided that people that voted wrong on taxes weren't really going to be welcome in terms of being reelected. And I think it's time that Democrats look about how we hold our elected officials accountable in terms of standing up for working people.
Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Kirk. Kirk's calling from Cleveland.
Hi there. Great show.
Thank you.
I was calling from two perspectives. One is someone who employs about 15 Teamsters in our local, in our warehouse here. And second is someone who would like to find home builder that employs union carpenters. The public perception I see, it seems to be stay away from the union, stay away from the union, when in fact I see a tremendous value in what the union members bring, whatever the trade be. perhaps a marketing effort that would position the union in the public mind or the public eye in a better perspective would be beneficial.
So you're not looking at unions, Kirk, from the viewpoint of if I hire union personnel, it's going to be a lot more bureaucracy and a lot more expensive.
No. The experience that we've had with our local union has been excellent. Anytime we've had a problem, we've made a call, they've sat down, worked with us, worked with the workers. There's never been an issue there.
Well, Cleveland's a union town, Andy Stern.
It's a union town, and you know, obviously we have a responsible employer who's trying, you know, to have a responsible relationship. And the good news is we have a union that's trying to give back in kind. And the building trades, if you think about it, is just a wonderful model in a country now that has more independent contractors. You know, building trades workers can work in different jobs. They can, you know, take their benefits wherever they go and their pensions wherever they go. And I just think we need to and get the training they need to do the job. I think all of America needs to look at that model.
Kirk, thanks for the call, and good luck finding a home builder for yourself. Bye-bye. We're talking with Andy Stern. He's the president of the Service Employees International Union, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line, and this will be on our international line. Greg is calling from Worms in Germany.
Yeah, in Worms, Germany. Hi, how you doing?
Very well, thank you.
I just wanted to make a comment. I'm in complete agreement with Mr. Stern that the unions ought to consolidate more. They've done that historically here in Germany. The unions are pretty strong here. However, they're also much less militant than they are in the States. Typically what happens is you have unions here that handle a whole industry, say like chemical industry. They negotiate contracts with heads of companies, and then the whole industry accepts the contract that gets negotiated. You probably all know we have excellent pay and benefits over here.
Mm-hmm. Is that German model something that you've looked at, Andy Stern?
Yeah, I mean, I think the German model has a lot of things going for it. It really is a model that has all the employers and industry sitting at the table together with the union. The decisions that are made affect everyone. And I think the caller's right. I mean, there needs to be, though, enough attention to what goes on at the workplaces, because we just can't have a top-down labor movement. We also have to have a bottom-up labor movement. And sometimes when you have as much power as the German unions do, or as the Democratic Party once had, you know, you tend to forget how you got there and who put you into office. And I hope the German unions, you know, make sure they keep that right balance between.
I hope so, too, yeah.
Thanks for the call, Greg.
Okay, thank you very much.
And I did want to expand this conversation onto the other focus of your ideas, which is to say, all right, even if the AFL-CIO accepted everything that me, Andy Stern, have proposed to them, that just solves the problem in this country. There's an international problem from your point of view.
Well, I just think we live in an international and a global world with economies that are becoming, you know, more integrated every single day. And so as the Germans are learning, it's hard to protect your standards in your company when, you know, Volkswagen can move a plant into Poland or the Czech Republic and pay half the wages and benefits. And so,
Or South Carolina.
And so it really is time for unions in this world to appreciate that a global economy requires global unions. And we've begun to take the first steps of meeting with unions around the world to talk about, is it possible to really have a global labor movement, not just about solidarity, but about having specific direct relationships with employers.
And one of those ideas that I've read about was to approach unions in China to help deal with the Walmart problem, for one.
Yeah, I mean, there are unions in China that need a lot of work. They're in transformation. And we should hope in the labor movement that they end up being the kind of unions we see in Germany, not necessarily the kind of unions we see in the U.S., that they're social democratic unions with the kind of social benefits that they have in Europe. But they hold the key in many ways to what happens with Walmart. I mean, Walmart is the fifth largest importer of goods from China, more than France or England as countries import. The workers there, you know, have not seen their labor living standards rise because Walmart has brought jobs to China. In fact, those workers are making $40 a month. And yes, we're talking to the unions in China about we need their help to bring the wages and benefits of the workers that manufacture all those goods that appear on American shelves from China up, because if not, we're not going to sell anything. in America ever again. And Sam Walt would probably roll over in his grave if he saw how much Chinese products are being carried on the stores of Walmart up and down this North America.
When we come back from a break, we'll discuss whether that may be a good or a bad idea for American workers. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. After we finish our conversation with Andy Stern, we'll also talk about a new report that critiques the way the news media covers rural America and your letters. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Now we're going to wrap up our discussion on empowering labor unions. Still with us is Andy Stern, president of the Service Employees International Union. And just before the break, we were talking about ideas of organizing workers in places like India and China, well, for their own benefits, but also this idea of international unions to deal with international corporations. But is any of that going to help the American worker?
Well, first, I think we have to start by saying that someone should sue for false advertising in terms of our trade agreements. You know, we were told that trade was going to be the answer to all of our problems, that jobs going overseas were really going to be a difference because we could have the white-collar programming biomedical technology jobs. And A, that hasn't been true. There's a huge problem about rewarding work in union. That's part of this discussion that we're having here about rebuilding the labor movement. Two is that we're beginning to hear people like Congressman DeFazio say, you know, maybe we should pull out of the WTO. Maybe the agreements we have really aren't good for American workers. I think we have to really seriously look at how are we going to have trade agreements that work fairly for everyone. And part of the solution is trying to bring up the wages and benefits of workers in India and China and other countries. In the same way in New Jersey, we tried to get all the workers to make the same wages so that competition was based upon efficiency and quality and innovation. I think we're never going to have it all equal around the world, but we can certainly not have the kind of gaps we currently have that I just think make this thing happen a lot faster. And we've learned in America when jobs are outsourced from the public sector to the private sector, we can raise those workers' wages and benefits up, and that's just what we want to do around the world.
Here's an email from Ethan Hamm in Portland, Oregon. How about trying to institute an international minimum wage, perhaps as some sort of U.S. requirement for imports? If we insisted on workers in other countries earning, say, a dollar an hour, it wouldn't increase the prices of the good we buy that much, make our workers more competitive, and it would do the right thing in terms of helping very poor people.
I think those are exactly the kind of ideas that would help America, help American workers, as well as help workers around the world. Dick Gephardt actually had that proposal. First time ever a presidential candidate talked about an international minimum wage. Congressman DeFazio is talking about changing the WTO. Something has to be done because this sort of fundamentalist view that the market will solve all problems, this fundamentalist view that shareholder value is all what it's about, is not true. Too many American workers don't have health care, don't have wages, takes two or three jobs to raise a family. They need their work valued and rewarded, and that's not happening in America today.
Let's get another caller in. This is Dawn. Dawn's calling from South Bend, Indiana.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to comment on the union labor issue. I was a union member for 9 years and then became a manager for the same company, so I saw both sides of the spectrum. I think for unions to get instilled in other places, they need to get rid of the adversarial environment that is created between the union and the company. When I was a union employee, all of the so-called good workers, we didn't like the union because they were protecting the people who probably should have been fired. Excuse me. And we had to join them because we didn't really have a choice. As a manager, I didn't like the union because it held my hands back from rewarding good employees. The other comment I had was, the union needs to have a common goal, excuse me, and they never really seem to be interested in the thriving of the company. Wages are important and health care is important, but nobody ever had an answer on the union's end on how we could do that and still let the company survive. And that's a really big issue that we need to resolve.
I totally agree that we have to understand that employers exist for a purpose, whether it's a family-owned business or a big corporation, you know, and that is, you know, to make money. Our job as a union movement is to make sure that the competition occurs equally, so we're not just making the union employers unable to compete with the non-union employers, and two is making sure that the growth of the company, the profits of the company are shared fairly. We don't need CEOs making 500 times more than the average worker does. That's so much more than they make in any other country. So, A, it's a question of making sure our employers are successful and can compete fairly, and two is making sure that the hard work of the people that work there is distributed appropriately amongst all the people that make that company as successful as it is.
Mm-hmm. But what about Dawn's other point, of the common goal? I mean, is there a thesis here that goes beyond, well, as some have described, the philosophy of the American labor movement for the last 50 years can be encapsulated in one word, more?
Well, Samuel Gompers did say that, and clearly what we want to also say is we want more quality, you know, more efficiency. At Kaiser, for instance, we initiated a process to have a partnership at the bedside because we were concerned about the quality of health care that was being delivered. And now we and the employer work together with one common goal, as was talked about, which is to how to make Kaiser the highest quality provider in the marketplace. It's the same kind of discussion we're having with security officers. How do they get the training and the skills they need to be successful in a post-9/11 economy? So I absolutely agree that we need to have our discussions being about how to add value to our employers, how to provide greater quality, how to make our employers the most successful employers, and how to make sure that every employer treats their workers fairly.
Dawn, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you. Bye.
Before we let you go, Andy Stern, now that you were disappointed with the results of your meeting in Las Vegas a few weeks ago, where do you go from here? And where, more importantly, does the SEIU go from here?
Well, I think we learned another disappointing lesson in Las Vegas, and that was that up until now we'd been saying the issue is not who heads the AFL-CIO, but which way is the AFL-CIO headed. But I was incredibly disappointed with President Sweeney, the president of the AFL-CIO, because for so many years he's been saying to me and others in our union that he really supports the ideas about growth. He really supports a series of proposals that he once initiated about how the union movement could come together and grow stronger and build a bigger union. Yet despite saying that and despite having 40% of the people agreeing with that proposition, he went in a different direction and said that we need to give more money to politics and politicians. And I think we now have a disappointment that we have a leadership issue inside the AFL-CIO as well as an issue about its program and policies.
Well, I hear you have an issue. Are you leaving the AFL-CIO?
Well, we're going to fight to have a program that allows workers' work to be valued and rewarded in America. We're going to fight to have a leader of the AFL-CIO who supports that program. And if not, we'll be partners with the AFL-CIO, but not part of it.
Thank you very much. Andy Stern is president of the Service Employees International Union, and he joined us here today in Studio 3A.